This meeting is now being recorded.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the new GTLD Subsequent Procedures Subteam Track 3, String Contention, Objections, and Disputes, held on the 2nd of May, 2017. In the interest of time, there'll be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. If you're only on the audio bridge, could you please let yourself be known now?
Sure, here I'm going to be in the AC eventually, but I'm only in the audio at the moment.
Thank you, Cheryl. Hearing no further names, I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for recording purpose, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll turn it back over to our co-chair, Robin Gross. Please begin.
Thank you very much. Thanks to everyone who's joined in the call today. We've got a great topic, the freedom of expression rights in the new GTLD program, it's very exciting. Let me quickly review our agenda. Updates to statements of interest, and then status update from a plenary co-chair. We've got Avery on the line today for that. And we can dig right into the meat of our discussion on applicant freedom of expression rights in the new GTLD program. We'll do a little bit of background on the issue, where some of this comes from, the 2007 final report, and then some of the GAC issues that came up afterwards, and then the board response to those issues and how the policy ultimately got hammered out. And then we can have some discussion on the use of the GTLD policy and how does it protect applicants' freedom of expression rights, and then any other business. Is there anyone who has any questions or comments on the agenda? Would like to add anything else on the business? Okay, well, I'm not seeing any hands or hearing any voices. So let's just move into it. Does anyone have any updates to their statement of interest that they would like to make? This would be a good time to do that. Okay. Don't see any updates on that. So let's go forward. Next, we've got the status update from our plenary co-chair, Avery Doria. Avery, can you... Give us a nice update.
Yeah.
Hi. Thanks.
Hi. Yeah, this is Audrey speaking. So over the last couple of plenary meetings, we've been working on the CCT comment. And at the meeting that we had, it was yesterday or this morning, basically did another read-through of that. This would be the second. Went through... there were some paragraphs where there was some wordsmithing discussion, and they're going out today, and basically we want to get this completed and filed away by the 10th. So that's mostly what's been happening in the plenary meeting. We also just gave a reminder to people to get involved with the drafting teams that they've joined up. Those are the critical CC1 issues that we really need to close on. And, you know, following through the next reminder that, of course, the CC2 is out there, and hopefully everybody is busy crafting answers for that everywhere. And there was a reminder that there would be no, I think it's next week, there will be no... new GTLD program meetings because of the GDD meeting, but I'm not. Somebody from staff, either Steve or Emily, please confirm the dates on that for me because I've got it in my calendar, but I don't have my calendar in front of me. And I guess that's about it. I don't see Jeff online to add anything I've forgotten, but Emily and Steve, if there's anything I've forgotten, please chime in. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Avery. Is there anyone who had any questions or comments for Aubrey. Okay, I'm just hearing silence and not seeing any questions, so I guess that's good. We can go forward. Let's then dive right into the meat of today's agenda, which is applicant freedom of expression rights in the new GTLD program. And so for some background on this, where do these rights come from in the new GTLD program, at least? There are two places that are very explicit about protecting applicants' freedom of expression rights, and one is in Principle G of the final report, and also Recommendation 3 of the final report. Principle G says the string evaluation process must not infringe the applicant's freedom of expression rights. And Recommendation 3 says strings must not infringe the existing legal rights of others, in particular freedom of expression rights. So that's where this concern got embedded into the new GTLD policy. And I think one of the things that's important to realize about what these the principles and recommendations from the 2007 final report, one of the things is that it was approved by both the GNSO Council and the board. And so these principles are basically a combination of GNSO committee priorities and the ICANN staff implementation principles that are developed in tandem with the committee, and then also the March 2007 GAC public policy principles on new top-level domains. And I think it's also worth noting that these principles were supported by all of the GNSO constituencies when they went through the through the votes on the GNSO Council before it went to the board. So that sort of very quick background of how freedom of expression found its way into the new GTLD program. Go on to the next slide. And then in terms of what are applicants' freedom of expression rights, there's a couple international treaties that focus on this, and one is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 19. Everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression. This right includes freedom to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas through any medium and regardless of frontiers. And then another critical international covenant on freedom of expression, also Article 19, but in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which also very explicitly spells out that everyone has the right to freedom of expression and seeking, receiving, imparting information of all kinds, regardless of frontiers, whether orally, in writing, or in print, in the form of art, or through any other media of his choice. So, again, these are very broad protection that people have for freedom of expression under international treaties. Okay. And so let's also talk a little bit about what does GAC advice mean in this context when there are concerns about TLD strings and the GAC wants to issue advice. What does that actually mean? In terms of whether or not that string can go forward. So basically, the GAC issues advice on strings that they see as being problematic, that potentially violates national law or raises sensitivities. So if the GAC advice is based on consensus of the GAC, which keep in mind it's not easy to achieve that consensus, it will create a strong presumption that the application should not be approved. And if the ICANN board does not act in accordance with this type of advice, it must provide a rationale for doing so. So basically, if the GAC advises that there are concerns about a particular string, then the board is expected to enter into a dialogue with the GAC, understand the scope of the concerns, and provide a rationale for its decision. And this can go on a little bit. If the GAC advises that the application should not proceed unless remediated, this will create a strong presumption that the application should not proceed unless there is a remediation method available in the guidebook. And ultimately, if the issue is not remediated, the board is expected to provide a rationale for its decision if it doesn't follow GAC advice. So in a nutshell, there's a presumption that the application isn't to go forward, but the board ultimately has a decision, and provided they provide the rationale for their decision. Well, I'm sorry, I'm just now seeing this in the chat. Somebody says, can we go back a slide to the last slide? Okay. Apologies. Yes, Paul, so, please go ahead.
Okay. Thanks, Robin. Paul McGrady here. We just ran through that last slide so fast that I think it's worth noting that these things were things that the human rights subteam for Workstream 2 dealt with in great detail for many, many weeks. And, Robin, I'm sure you didn't mean to say something as so expansive as, you know, these treaties, you know, ensure everybody has freedom of expression. Some of these are just declarations, they're not treaties. You know, lots of people in lots of countries can't go in and to the courts and insist on their freedom of expression rights based upon these documents. They're good documents, but they don't necessarily, you know, they're not, collectively don't come together to form a global First Amendment for all speakers everywhere. That said, whether or not they do those things doesn't change the text of the GENASO Council policy advice about protecting expression rights. And so I just wanted to go back and, you know, drop the footnote that these are great, but these aren't the things that govern. What should be governing here is the GENASO Council policy, which was adopted not only by the council, but as you said, by the board. And I don't think we necessarily have to look all that closely at these documents, because the GENASO Council advice is pretty straightforward and clear. It doesn't, you know, there's not a lot of caveats and exceptions to what was said there. Thanks.
Thanks, Paul. And yeah, I actually didn't mean to imply that we need to spend a lot of time looking at these documents, but I just wanted to give people some background as to where that recommendation G and or principle G and recommendation 3 had come from, like what was sort of their basis. And so, okay. Did anyone else have any questions on this before we go forward? Okay, I don't see anything, so let me go forward to slide number 5, which is going back to GAC advice, and in particular the 2013 GAC advice. So GAC issued some pretty strong advice in 2003, advice with a capital A, and they basically against strings that were considered sensitive or what they described as problematic or in regulated markets. And so this really sort of began with their Beijing communique, where they said strings that are linked to regulated or professional sectors should operate in a way that is consistent with applicable laws. I don't think anyone would argue with we should all follow the law. So that seems pretty straightforward. And then also in the Beijing communique, the GAC proposed specific safeguards that would apply to a broad category of strings related to what they considered consumer protection, sensitive strings, and regulated markets. And they also made a statement in the Beijing communique regarding generic terms, and they said, for strings representing generic terms, exclusive registry access should serve a public interest goal. And so that is sort of one of the impetuses for where what we see later, what happened with generic strings, comes from. And then, again, in the other two meetings in 2013, GAC issued, again, advice against what they considered problematic strings, those that potentially violate national law or raise sensitivities. Although it's worth noting that, you know, raising sensitivities is pretty vague and ambiguous of a concept, but nonetheless, that's what they said. Okay, so going on, So what was the board's response to the GAC advice on some of these strains that had been applied for that were considered sensitive, problematic, or in regulated markets? Basically, a lot of these strains got divided into two buckets, one called Category 1 strains and the other called Category 2 strains. And then in 2014, the board's new GTLD program committee adopted an implementation framework for treating Category 1 strains. Again, those are considered to be in regulated markets or that potentially violate national law or raise sensitivities. So what they decided with respect to these, what they're calling Category 1 strains, is that it requires one of three levels of different types of what they're calling safeguards or restrictions. If it's a regulated sector, it would be open entry requirements in multiple jurisdictions. If it's what they consider to be a highly regulated sector, then they wanted closed entry requirements in multiple jurisdictions. And then the sort of special safeguards required is sort of a catch-all category for raising sensitivities. There were, for example, some religious strings that got put in that category. And so what was dealt with here, or how these were dealt with here, was the creation of Specification 11 to the Register Agreement, and it was called a public interest commitment for strings that had been considered within Category 1. Okay. We go on to the Category 2. So Category 2 strains, again, is what is being called so-called generics. A generic string, meaning it's a string that's consisting of a word or term that denotes or describes a general class of goods, services, groups, organizations, or things, as opposed to distinguishing a specific brand of goods, services, groups, organizations, or things. Those are other things. So, you know, there's a lot of words that could be considered a generic string. And then in 2005, the board adopted a policy for treating what they were calling these Category 2 strings, basically would not allowing imposing the eligibility criteria for registering names in that top-level domain. So they weren't going to allow exclusivity in registration of a word that was considered a generic. So that's a lot of words that had just been taken off the market for all but essentially one business model at board resolution. Okay, so yes, and as Paul notes in the text, they're currently discussing generic terms in the legal work team of this PDP. I think that's work team 2. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but we're just focusing on it here from the freedom of expression angle, from that perspective. Okay, so that sort of brings us to some of our questions for discussion today about how did this new GTLD policy treat freedom of expression rights that applicants have when we're talking about, in particular, Category 1 and Category 2 strings. I know we've talked about the geo names before, and I expect we're going to have to focus in on talking about it again. But so for today's discussion, we're just trying to focus a bit more on the Category 1 and Category 2 strings, those that are considered to be sensitive, problematic, in regulated markets, or generics. So, you know, I just come up with some questions here, hoping they will prompt or provoke some discussion on this topic. Did the final guidebook policy and the implementation plan, did it comport with the approved policy for protecting applicants' freedom of expression rights? Should applicants use the words that are considered sensitive, problematic, or generic be exempt from ordinary freedom of expression rights? And importantly, how do the ICANN bylaws require handling of competing policy preferences, as in this case between the GAC or the GNSO on a particular GTLD policy? And I think we should also ask ourselves, is legitimate speech being chilled by this policy of Category 1 and Category 2 strings, or do people think that this has been a good approach and something we need to replicate in the next round? So with that, I just want to open it up and see what others have to think about this issue. Anybody want to sort of get in the queue on how applicants' freedom of expression rights were handled or should be handled in the GTLD policy? Okay, I see Anne's got her hand up. Anne, please, come in. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Robin. It's Anne for the transcript. And I had participated on Workstream 2 in the human rights framework of interpretation. I think there are others on this call who did as well. So I guess in terms of coordinating how we develop the policy, seems as though this group would be in a good position to observe, I guess, the comments that are being made on the framework of interpretation for human rights because of the way the new core value works, and some of which is, of course, it's subsequent to this discussion that we've had regarding history, which I think it's always good to know the history. But there, in terms of the current developments within ICANN, there's a human rights framework of interpretation that deals pretty directly with this topic that I think that we as a group would need to take into account the work done by Workstream 2 on that, on human rights. That was really choppy. I apologize.
No, I got it perfectly, and I think you're absolutely right. And I know that a lot of work is being done in that particular into accountability on the framework of interpretation for the human rights commitment in the bylaws, and we don't want to duplicate each other. We don't want to conflict with each other. So I know we've talked in the we need to work together with them, and I know we've talked in the past about doing that, but I don't think we've actually sat down and had that conversation like we should. So I appreciate that reminder that we need to do that. Thank you. Okay, I see Alan's got his hand up. Please, Alan, come in.
Thank you. I wish the world was as simple as that, that we simply have to wait for the human rights group to tell us what to do, but it's not. One of the things that this group has to do is consider the statements from the GAC and the ALAC on concerns about the expectations that people have based on the name of the names within the GTLD, the TLD name itself, and what they expect. And the CCP review is doing a lot of work on that because it similarly was charged. And at this point, their draft review talks about the fact that there is some evidence, or there appears to be the case, that users are starting to presume certain things about TLDs based on the names, and that's partly because there are at least a few TLDs where they are making commitments about what to expect because of the name, and bank insurance are the classic ones. So I don't think we're going to be able to come up with a definitive answer in this, at least until the CCT review team comes out with their final report and see where they come down on how important is it for us to worry about whether there are expectations being set that we have to consider, or whether indeed it's just a matter of freedom of expression. So I don't think we're anywhere near the position where we can make a decision, and it's certainly not going to be simple based on one report or another. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. I see Paul McGrady has also got his hand up. Please, Paul, go ahead.
Thanks, Robin. Paul McGrady again. To add an extra wrinkle into all this, while I do think that the Workstream 2 work is useful. I don't think there is any mechanism for cross-community groups to do away with GNSO policy that's already been adopted by the council and adopted by the board. And so while I think it is helpful to follow along on what the CCWG is doing, I don't think at the end of the day that they can unilaterally undo policy that came out of a properly formed PDP. I think that, you know, those are just two completely different things. And I suppose that if the CCWG Workstream 2 comes up with something that the board then thinks they have to go back and take a look at every policy they ever adopted, that might trigger some fresh work on those PDPs, resurrected PDPs or whatever. I have no idea what that would look like. But I don't necessarily think that, we should jump to the conclusions that if a review team or a cross-community working group comes to a more narrow point of view on this freedom of expression issue than what was passed in Paris all those years ago, that we're automatically bound by it. I don't think there's a mechanism in the bylaws for that, and I've gone on too much. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. And I think actually you've raised a really good point that it could perhaps be in violation of the bylaws for the policy to be made any other way other than how it is specified in Annex A of the bylaws. So thank you. Greg, please go ahead.
Thanks. This is Greg Chatton for the record. I've been participating a little bit in the Workstream 2 human rights subgroup. So, you know, from my point of view, the work of that subgroup is really rather limited, which was just to provide a framework for consistent interpretation of the human rights bylaw created in Workstream 1. I think that, you know, some of the considerations there, you know, will be germane in looking at the bylaw, but I don't think there's going to be anything coming out of the Workstream 2 subgroup that is, you know, going to turn the process on its head or unveil something that is going to, you know, be a game changer here necessarily. There's kind of an overall issue, I guess, for subsequent rounds working group to look at the new bylaws, including the whole mission core values, mission commitments and core values section, and kind of see if there's anything there that, you know, requires a rethink. But that's kind of a big picture issue. So while I think the human rights bylaw is something that, you know, we work hard to shape and to get, I question whether there's anything in essence to wait for in terms of the work of Workstream 2. We can certainly talk if we want about what the human rights bylaw says, but again, I think that's kind of, you know, something for us to consider in policy is, you know, in terms of a much larger set of questions. So just kind of, you know, wanted to caution, at least from my point of view, if there isn't any sermon being written on the mount in Workstream 2 human rights subgroup that is going to be then sent down from the mount for us to somehow find a new way of thinking. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg. I've got Avery and then Anne in the queue. Please, Avery, go ahead.
Thank you. This is Avery speaking, and speaking personally. One of the things I think I agree with that Greg said, that we don't have to wait for it, in that it pretty much already exists, the framework. I mean, yes, it's going through drafting and such, but it's a guideline at best. But I do think that it has value in the new GTLD process, because one of the things that GTLDs and working groups do and are pretty much mandated to do is to do a certain look at the impact of the policy decisions. And the framework, to a certain extent, frames what form those can come in and how they can go. It only gives guidelines. It only gives clues. But I do think it might be a useful tool more at the micro level, but it isn't just the big picture. But when you get down to our policies and you start talking, what is the human rights impact of what we're doing, then it becomes viable. So what is the human right impact of certain restrictions on freedom of expression, on certain rules, and looking at a specific policy or sub-policy and say, well, wait a second, have we looked at the impact of this? How would this work? I think the way it gives guidance on that may indeed be useful. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Avery. Anne, please go ahead.
Yes, thanks, Robin. It's Anne for the transcript. First, I wanted to clarify that I was not saying that this group needs to wait for the, you know, the finalization of the FOI HR in order to do anything. I'm not sure what created that impression, but that is not at all what I was thinking. I was thinking that it's relevant for this group to consider the work done in Workstream 2 on the FOI HR. Regarding Paul's comment about changing GNSO policy, no, nobody can change GNSO policy unless and until the GNSO changes policy. Now, with respect to Workstream 2 work, that work in its final form will go to the GNSO as a chartering organization, and the GNSO will have the opportunity to give input, adopt whatever, the framework of interpretation for human rights. Why do I bring that up? One of the important principles established in the development of the framework of interpretation for human rights is the fact that there's no one human right that absolutely takes precedent over other human rights. In other words, it's the principle that Greg Shatton calls no cherry picking. And so there's a balancing, and that's contained in the draft framework of interpretation for human rights, that there's no cherry picking among the human rights. And so, of course, as a trademark lawyer, I'm obligated to mention that there are aspects of author's rights, as well as property rights, that are part of the Universal Declaration as well. And so I have to disagree with those who say that the framework of interpretation for human rights, when it reaches its final form, will not have any effect on what we're already doing, because I think it is just that. It's a proposed framework of interpretation for human rights. If it has no effect on what we're doing, you know, why on earth do we do it? So I just think this group needs to take into account the principles that are put forth there. I don't know if this group wants to comment on the FOI HR. I don't know where we want to go with it, but it is quite relevant. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Anne. Greg, please, go ahead.
Thanks. Greg Shatton again. Just to clarify, I wasn't saying it would have no impact, but, you know, rather that, you know, we'll need to look at it in the overall context of the human, of the bylaw, which itself is a core value, which, as Alan notes in the chat, is one of several core values that need to be balanced against each other and considered with each other. So it's not a cut and dried analysis. Also, wanted to clarify that the framework of interpretation does not mandate a human rights impact assessment. It suggests, I believe, that individual SOs and ACs can consider how in their processes they should look at human rights issues, and that can include a human rights impact assessment. So again, the concept of subsidiarity or primacy, depending upon how you look at it, says that the GNSO sets the policy development processes, not a cross community working group. So it's up to the GNSO council or the GNSO, I think, to determine if it's and when its PDP process should include a human rights impact assessment as a kind of a mandated part of that. Of course, there are all sorts of things that PDP working groups can put in their charter that they decide to do, whether it's answering charter questions or the like. So there's still a lot of flexibility in all of this. But again, in terms of what the bylaw and the framework set out, it's I think we need to be clear. I hope we don't have to veer off into a reading session of the framework, because I don't think or the bylaw or but if we do, it might be better to do so than to rely on the collective memory or collective memories, which are all in various stages of being fried. Anyway, so just wanted to kind of set that point out there, not suggesting that we are going to necessarily have the group do an HRIA here, but just that it's something that needs to be considered as a policy process issue and not something that's been mandated by the bylaw as interpreted by the framework. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg. Aubrey, is that an old hand or a new hand? If it's a new hand, just go, okay. Looks like you've taken it down, so I'll presume that's an old hand. Okay. Well, I don't want us to get too bogged down in trying to discuss the framework rotation for the human rights bylaw today, because I really want us to sort of focus our discussion today on these Category 1 and Category 2 strings and how they impact applicants' freedom of expression rights. And one thing that really struck me, at least when I was looking at this a little bit more closely, was that generally in our new GTLD policies, you weren't allowed to have a string that was illegal in some way. So what we've got here are sort of changing the words away from things like infringement. You can't have a string that infringes somebody's trademark, or you can't have a string that violates the law. These are fairly clear, unambiguous meanings, infringement and such. But what we see coming out of Category 1 and Category 2 are words that are considered sensitive or problematic or generic, something that isn't really defined anywhere in law, and are, frankly, conclusions about their wrongness as opposed to an argument for it. Or, when you say somebody is infringing somebody, a string is infringing, it's pretty clear that it's illegal and it should come down because the law has determined it's infringing. But when you say something is sensitive or problematic, that really doesn't provide for any kind of analysis as to whether or not it's appropriate nonetheless. Maybe somebody's a little bit too insensitive, or maybe it's a problem, a difficult conversation that needs to be had. So I just kind of wanted to throw that concept out there about what is really stands out for me about these Category 1 and Category 2 strings is sort of how this, loosey-goosey, ambiguous, fuzzy definitions that are generally conclusions for restricting a whole lot of lawful activity. And, I maybe think about it from that perspective for a moment. Okay, so I've sort of gone on enough there. Paul's got his hand up. Please, Paul, come in.
Thanks, Robin. This is Paul. So I think at the end of this, I'm going to tack on a sentence and say, But for those of you from outside of North America, please let us hear from you too, right? But I admit I'm bringing an enormous amount of cultural bias to this question because, you know, first of all, I think that these terms, sensitive and all that, those are not in the GNSO policy as adopted by the board. I think that they, this was a midstream modification of the policy, and there's a question about whether or not that was the purpose of, you know, GAC advice, if the GAC can undo GNSO policy. But setting aside the ICANN mechanics of it, you know, like I said, I'm bringing a bit of a North American bias to this, which is, you know, there are only a handful of things that you can't say in public places. You know, I come at it, you know, from that point of view. Right. So if a particular phrase is illegal in a, you know, a country, maybe because they have a certain, you know, history, with, you know, a political party that took them down a wrong road back in the 1940s, for example, I think that there's some restrictions about being able to you know, to use those words in commerce. We have other restrictions, trademark restrictions, which Robin mentioned, and those should be, you know, pretty obvious. You know, I can't apply for the .Xerox unless I'm Xerox. So we're not talking about those things. We're talking about a category of words that now, because they're sensitive to governments, that were, you know, no longer allowed to be used as, you know, as expressive speech. And, again, so this is where I say, you know, maybe we can hear from people who are not, who don't have that same North American bias that I do, because my reaction to whether or not a string is sensitive or problematic, you know, to a government is, you know, I hate to say it so blatantly, but, you know, so what? You know, our, you know, the North American approach is, you know, you can say it unless it's going to, you know, cause harm, physical harm almost, is the standard, but, you know, the crowded, you can't cry fire in a crowded theater because somebody might get trampled. But other than that, whether or not our government has any particular point of view about whether or not we should say it, it's not the first thing that's on our mind because we have protection from the government being unhappy with us for saying it. So anyways, I invite other people who have different points of view, especially if they are not from this continent. I admit that our approach here is not universal, and so I will be quiet now. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Paul. Alan, please come in.
I just wanted to comment on the fact that the U.S. is not all of North America. There are things you cannot say in the U.S. on public radio or television that you can in Canada, and I suspect the freedom of expression rights in Mexico are different from the U.S., perhaps greatly so. So let's not talk about the U.S. as if it was all of North America. The standards are moderately different in different countries, even within North America, and certainly when you go outside of North America. So let's just be careful the wording we use. Thank you.
Thank you. Anne, please, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Robin. It's Anne for the transcript. Trying to define freedom of expression as it's defined in so many different countries is, that's a real challenge. I have to agree again with Alan on that, as well as the statement that we need to consider the recommendations of the CCTRT as we're making policy on this. But the point I had actually raised my hand about was, in a way, it's a question. There's a big difference, I think, between what the GAC comments were with respect to generic strings versus the very vague sort of sensitive and problematic words that you were talking about. I thought the GAC concern here was regarding closed generics. Was there a general GAC concern in relation to generic words, or was it the what I call a consumer protection interest And I'll give a real extreme example. Somebody applies for a top-level domain dot freedom of expression. Should that be able to be closed, or does that infringe freedom of expression rights? Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, so where the generic part comes from, it's under the category 2 strings, and it's kind of interesting where that came from, because again, it was from the GAC having a communique in Beijing, where they said that they wanted strings with generic meanings had to be registered in a public with a public interest goal, and so that sort of over the course of the board and the GAC and other interested parties' discussions and negotiations, the way that came down was, yes, it was about exclusive registration for words that the GAC considered to be generic, or, excuse me, not GAC. Most of the time it turned out to be a competitor who wanted to use the word the top-level domain as well.
Yeah, if I may quickly follow up, Robin, may I? Yeah, it's Anne again. I almost feel that the GAC's observations regarding generic TLDs more support principles of freedom of expression than they do restrict them. Because I think what the GAC is saying...
Well, if I could just put...
Sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that I think that it's a restriction. The way that it is considered to be a restriction on speech is by telling someone that you're required to have open registration policy that doesn't allow people to only to be selective or to express themselves in the way that they want to express themselves, which might be only with a select identity or group of people. So I would sort of push back and argue that by requiring non-exclusive registration, you are infringing the registry's right to express itself as it chooses by deciding who they can allow to associate with as being a part of their registry. And I hope that makes sense. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Anne. If that's your hand is still up, please come in.
Yes, thanks, Robin. And I can see your point there. There's some competing interest involved. You know, we got into a bit of a discussion when we were talking about community applications and a notion that we might want to restrict the support that's given to community applications to those that serve some social good. Maybe there's, you know, a similar principle here in that if a registry can't, you know, operate under its own freedom of association guidelines, then, you know, you would consider there's some abridgment of the freedom of expression. I guess the question is, none of these human rights are actually totally absolute, and they're not under any society or under any government. And so the real question we're grappling with is what limits are appropriate as a matter of GTLD policy, because they're always competing.
Yeah, I think that's a really nice way to frame the discussion, actually. Greg, please, go ahead.
Thanks. In Greg Shatton for the record, and in listening to this, I'm a little concerned. You know, as much as important as the you know freedom of expression is, and I'm, you know, card-carrying member of the ACLU and all that stuff, but I'm concerned that we may be looking at things through a freedom of expression lens that are really not primarily freedom of expression or abridgment of freedom of expression concern. And it's precisely because of the power and importance of freedom of expression that I think people are so interested in wielding it as a as an element to support a worldview of how things should go. It's very, nobody wants to say they're against freedom of expression. So if somebody argues that their viewpoint is pro freedom of expression, you know, the first question becomes, well, does that mean I'm anti-freedom of expression? Or is kind of you as Robin and Ann kind of indicated, both sides of the coin may, you know, have freedom of expression pros and cons attached to them, which to some extent indicates to me that maybe we're not dealing with something that's primarily a freedom of expression problem, which I, to me, goes back to the issue of whether someone is unable to express their opinion and unable to hold their opinion in a way that, you know, keeps them from, you know, being, you know, kind of, it's almost more freedom of thought. And, you know, of course, you know, obviously there are, as we also discussed, so many different interpretations of freedom of expression, freedom of speech, but I think they do go to some extent to, you know, freedom of expressive speech. So I'm not sure whether .x, y, or z is necessarily expressive speech or not, or if managing .x, y, z one way versus another is pro or anti freedom of speech, just as managing doctor one way or the other is pro or anti freedom of speech, and, or whether it's even about freedom of speech at all. I'm you know, more concerned with actual oppression of expression, perhaps, which thankfully many of us don't have to deal with much, at least not in the first 102 days yet. But in any case, my point is that we need to kind of be careful about overusing freedom of expression, and also to try to decide what expression it is that is being abridged or hampered as we look through these things. And last, and I probably should have stopped talking about it a minute ago, but last, think about how this deals with other criteria and goals of the new GTLD program, such as innovation and competition. So it seems to me that trying to start saying that certain ways to run a GTLD are freedom of expression problems, that unless we can really show that somebody's expression, their ability to say what they want to say and to think what they want to think is being violated, that we need to think about whether other values are really more important and more indicative of what's going on here. Thanks. And obviously, I see, you know, I know that many people deal daily with oppression of freedom of expression, and I think we should respect that level of oppression of freedom of expression as we think about what we're talking about as freedom of expression issue now.
Thanks, Greg. And actually, freedom of expression, one of the important competing interests that the GNSO wanted to bake into the new GTLD policy. That's why it's specifically highlighted in Principle G and in Recommendation 3, the same way other perfectly legitimate rights are in the new GTLD policy. You know, there's a recommendation or two on protecting trademarks, and we've got entire PDPs set out to make sure that that happens. So this is the day that we get to discuss whether or not the freedom of expression protections are adequate in the new GTLD policy. And while I do not mean to, you know, conflate the freedom of expression issues that we deal with in ICANN with others that go on in, you know, much more repressive parts of the world, I think it's important to realize that we are creating this global governance structure from the bottom up, and if we do in fact care about all of these different interests like protection, freedom of expression, then we do try to bake them into our policies, and we do spend a day or two discussing whether or not we adequately met that goal and what we can do differently next time to make sure that we do. So that's just, you know, sort of my pushback here, as I don't see anyone else in the queue. Greg, is that an old hand or a new hand? And then I see Alan. Okay.
I'll just say very briefly that I agree, and I'm not trying to stop the discussion of freedom of expression. Just I'm trying to put it in a larger context, the context of the other goals, and a context of kind of level setting about what a violation of freedom of expression may actually be. But certainly, it's a necessary discussion, and obviously an interesting one, or none of us would have shown up today.
Great. Thanks very much. Alan, you have the floor.
Thank you. Thank you. As I noted in the chat earlier, freedom of expression is one of our core issues, but it's not the only one, and these things will have to be balanced. So it's not a matter of whether it's important or not, and how important is this freedom of expression versus some of the other more egregious things that go on in the world. But there are different things we're balancing, and ultimately we're going to have to look at them all, not simply say it's important, therefore. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alan. I do not see anyone else in the queue, and as I look at the time, we've got 1 minute, so Alan gets the last word on this topic. Was there any other business that anyone else want to bring up before we bring this meeting to a close? And I'm very appreciative for all of you who participated today and brought such interesting perspectives. Okay, well, I do not see any other hands or hear any voices. Okay, so I will, it's on the hour now, so I will call this meeting to a close, and we'll see you all again in 2 weeks. Excuse me, our next call is actually the Tuesday, 23 May at 1500 UTC. Thanks so much, Terry.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye. Thanks, Robin.
Thanks, Robin.
Thank you. Once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Thank you very much for joining.